Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Before we start, I want to just give a message of health and happiness, everyone. Hope everyone's doing well and, you know, getting through this tough time that we're all facing. So thanks for joining us. Thanks for your time. I'll introduce our speaker today, my co-panelists here, Eddie Shapiro of Nest Seekers International. Eddie's been in the real estate business for about 25 years. Throughout the years, he's developed, managed, and invested in almost every real estate asset class. He's the founder and CEO of Nest Seekers International. They're a large, successful brokerage firm with offices in New York, London, the Hamptons, LA, and Miami, over 1,000 agents, and 20 offices spread around the world. Last year, Nest Seekers sold the most expensive spec house in the entire country, and two of the largest ocean fronts in the Hamptons. He also represents a large portfolio of new developments and continues to be a broker for iconic homes throughout the markets they operate. Happy to have him. Eddie, welcome.
Hello. Hello, everyone.
So let's get into it, Eddie. People are interested to hear, you know, what you have to say. The market, as you know, is very interesting right now. And I think one thing that people always find compelling is learning and talking about New York City real estate. And given your expertise in that market, let's start right there. You know, what are you currently seeing in the New York City co-op condo market? What changes? What's going on? Give us your update, if you don't mind.
So definitely a significant change in the past, say, about 10 days, gradually coming back to life. It started with, from days into the shutdown, it just came to a complete halt almost. Shock mode. Buyers that were in contract didn't know what to do. Should they close? Should they not? Where is this headed? It was really a shock effect across the marketplace. Buyers that were in looking weren't sure. Were they supposed to buy? What are they doing right now? What's going to happen? Real estate values? What's going to happen to in the middle of negotiations? And so there was a real shock for a good few weeks. And slowly some energy came back to the marketplace. Then we got into, are we supposed to do this? Can we do this? Can we show properties? Can we sell properties? It was quickly then announced that real estate is an essential business. And so we're able to transact. And then within a couple of weeks, you know, the closing started to move forward and we learned how to practice remotely, very quickly. One of the great things about real estate agents and our industry is that we adapt very, very quickly. And we find ways, and I've been saying to many of our agents that we've also been preparing ourselves for this for the past 10, 15 years in some ways. So many aspects of our business have already become virtual and have already been adjusted to work remotely, and so many things can be done without having all to be in everyone get in the room and try to do closings or negotiate in person. We've had these virtual tours and the video tours and the high quality photography and Matterport 3D tours in place for years. And so all we have to do is just put these practices now more often than we did before and adopt them more than we ever before and slowly figure our way through this. And so,
Eddie, do you think the buyers are actually receptive to those newer forms of, you know, marking these properties and the different level of maybe seeing them and walking through them? Is that going to be a hindrance for people buying, you think, right now? Or are people going to actually be more proactive and actually, you know, transact? I mean, what are you seeing looking for the next 6 weeks, 12 weeks, 25 weeks, you know?
So as I mentioned, the first few weeks were an adjustment period, a first shock, then, okay, let's figure out how we do this. Then a lot went forward. You know, we saw an incredible trend of people that quickly wanted to get out of the city. So there was movements outside of New York City and, you know, out to the suburbs, Long Island, Jersey, and so on.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, I think, like I said, people are adapting to the way that things are done. And so there was no, I don't think that it'll be much of an obstacle because we're finding ways to operate in this environment. And you can see the faith and the confidence coming back to the marketplace. And in the past 10 days, we've seen an incredible increase in inquiries and people wanting to get back out there and figure out how to buy real estate, and how to close on transactions. Closing went forward through the entire period of the shutdown. And within 2 weeks, we've all learned how to do virtual closings.
Yeah, and, exactly. You know, commercials also kind of migrated that way as well in many cases. And they're adapting, just like you said, it's adapting. Yeah. You know, one thing that I think about with what's going on is, what is short-term, what's long-term, right? Condo co-ops, it sounds like demand is coming back, velocity, inquiry, et cetera. I mean, when you talked about with me before this call, where we kind of prepped ourselves of, you know, the effects on retail in Manhattan, the effects on office, you had some really interesting thoughts. I thought that the listeners could, hear your take as how you think that plays out, whether it be rent reductions or higher vacancies or a migration to different ways of working. You want to share some of those thoughts we talked about?
So let's talk about the timeline, right? Real estate, the process is a month long. It's not like stocks. It's not like other class assets where you can see the effects taking place within days, within weeks, right? So we now have restaurants, businesses. Let's start with hospitalities. It's been pretty much shut down for 3 months. Many of them are not coming back. It's a lot of retail space, malls. They occupy offices. They may come back. Some of them may not. They certainly will not be able to operate the way that they did just 3-4 months ago.
Right.
Is it worth it for them to come back? And so many people in that hospitality business are asking themselves those questions. And some have already thrown the towel. We know that some of the biggest chains have already walked away from their leases and working their way out. And we'll wait to see what's the new reality looks like for the restaurant business, for the hospitality business. So then you have companies that have learned to operate in this environment. Twitter announced that until the end of the year, all of their employees can work from home. Okay, so what does that mean for their office spaces? And what does that mean for the rest of the tech sector or other industries, banking, real estate? You know, do we have to do this? Or have we learned to do so much more of this work, working from home and not really needing that much office space? So we know that there's an incredible amount of renegotiations of leases, people defaulting on their agreements, on their leases and office space, retail, so on and so forth. You know, you take a walk now down Fifth Avenue, Madison Avenue, it's not a pretty sight. There's a lot of stores that are boarded up. And some of them don't, it really doesn't look like it's a temporary thing. It looks like it's pretty much permanent. There are stores that just took their merchandise and emptied a store and walked away, took down the sign. I don't know when it happened. I watched one of the big food chain. I don't want to name the name of the company, but they were tearing apart their kitchen setup in the front and just kind of packing it in the back of the truck. I said, are you coming back? They said, we're not coming back. So all of these businesses that are now have walked away from their leases, takes time, but they're not paying their rents. Landlords are now not getting that income and they are probably will either default or start doing their workouts with their banks.
Yep.
It's going to go into default of loans. And, you know, there could be a months long worth of working through this crisis. And I think that we're yet to see the worst of it from commercial real estate standpoint.
I would concur with that. I mean, we mentioned the need for lower rents to happen in retail, in your mind, for high street retail or even these neighborhoods where the businesses simply cannot make the math work when you're paying 30, 40, 50% of your gross revenue to your landlord. And the margins are not good enough in these businesses to make that margin work. And there has to be some kind of reset. If I think it's a term you use, a reset of where those rents come to. That takes time, though, for, I think, landlords to actually adjust to that new reality. to your point, it takes months, if not years, and they may wait for that one tenant who they think may show up. It's unclear how that happens right now.
Absolutely. So in residential is a little bit of a different experience. Volume has come down dramatically. Some of it has been compensated by transactions outside of New York City. If, you know, our business is kind of spread out. We're not just in New York. So we're seeing some of that volume picked up on Long Island and Jersey and South Florida. You can quickly see the recovery in terms of consumer sentiment and inquiries and showing requests that we're getting and online traffic. It's coming back faster than I think commercial is going to do. I think commercial is going to be a long, sustained reorganization of that entire marketplace. As it was, you go back 3-4 months, 6 months ago, we were already, you know, there were tenants there that just couldn't afford to do that. And we're just holding leases just to keep face with many of them really are losing money every month, but it was just holding on to a lot of these retail spaces for branding purposes.
Right? Yes.
So now they're asking themselves, do we need that anymore? Do we need that billboard anymore? Or do we take that money now and we put it on online and retargeting and digital marketing and, you know, adjust to the new reality? But I think there's a bit more optimism and short-term coming back in residential than in commercial. Commercial is just going to be a long process.
We're getting a lot of questions here, and I'm going to pivot a second because a lot of people are asking about specifically the condo co-op market in Manhattan. I know in some future questions that we have in our outline, we're going to talk about it a bit, but you mentioned more activity. Are you seeing bids coming in on properties for sale? I know inventory has dropped dramatically as people have said, hey, hold off. I don't want people in my house right now. But is the stuff that's actually on the market finding bidders and transacting? Are you finding that there's, you know, people are down bidding and getting hit? Like, what's some anecdotal color you'd provide for our listeners?
So it's a few things are happening, right? You have cultural shifts. Brooklyn, Long Island City are quite vibrant. Buyers that were interested in townhome, townhouses, private, those types of private residences continuing to perform. In some cases, we're getting close to full ask in this marketplace, you know, when we're able to transact and the interest is there. There's definitely been a drop in volume in apartment buildings, luxury co-ops, condominiums in the city. To begin with, one, you can't show, you can't, you know, there's a lot of restrictions in how and what they're allowing agents to do in terms of selling and marketing these properties. You know, so many buildings set their own rules. I spoke to someone today that told me that they went in to visit a unit, not showing, you know, complying with all of the rules and the guidelines, and they had to fill out a questionnaire. Someone took their temperature. They were even able to get into the building, you know, but that's unique to a specific building. It doesn't happen in every property. So Manhattan, I think, will, in terms of apartment buildings, will take a bit longer. So the interest is shifting a little bit. The buyers are still there. They're a bit more hesitant when it comes to co-ops and condos. And that's going to be, again, a longer process because of excess, because of the way that the buildings are managed. And so some properties have been taken off the market. Some have held listing through the month of April and May. But in other cases, we see anomalies. For example, we have a property that's in contract in the 30s plus million in a very in-demand building that is paying several millions above what someone else just closed on 4 or 5 months ago. But they've got to have that property. So you're going to have these anomalies, you know, certain, call it blue chip properties that will continue to be in demand and will work through whatever the state of the market is. But generally, it's co-ops and condos are probably the part of the market that's slowed down the most.
You know, you talk about a very high part of the market, the ultra, you know, 30 million plus, I think of as like a very rarefied buyer. In the more standard pricing, if that's even a real thing, but like $1.5 to $3 million for a New York City apartment, I'm sure there's a lot of units that price in that range. That's kind of where I think of where maybe younger folks or maybe pied-à-terres for retirees who want a place in the city, that's where I feel like there may be more dislocation. Is that an incorrect statement in your mind? Because it's more of a home, a full-time home for someone maybe that has they're renting now, they have a family and they want to expand or grow into a bigger place. Is that a part of the market where you may see more dislocation? because you still need a mortgage and you need to put down payment down and other factors? Or are you going to see a uniformity of kind of slow down and a gradual building back up?
I think it's a gradual building back up. This event has triggered situations that people may have thought about before, but weren't sure they were going to do that. And so one of the first things that were triggered is, let's get out of these apartment buildings. Okay, we need social distancing. You know, how do we protect ourselves? Let's get into a private residence with, you know, an acre of land or something around us so you know, the kids can run around. A lot of it also has to do with the reopening plan. Okay, when are we going to be feeling like we're reopening the city back again so that people feel more comfortable going up and down the elevator? Okay, so for now, you have a dislocating of people that were triggered by this event to say, okay, it's time to move to the suburbs. It's time to get a house outside. But at the same time, there are new people that are going to look at this and say, okay, there's some great opportunities now. I might be able to find, you know, there's some buildings downtown now that are offering huge discounts. You can do your down payments in stages and so down 20%. You put down 5% plus 5% plus 5%. So it's becoming more attractive to other people. And if I go back to previous events, you know, like, you know, say 9/11, when we first started our company, months after, and then after the 08 crash, you have a trigger event that gets people out of the market, but then new people come into the market to compensate for that. And so the recovery is always faster than we think that it actually is happening on the street. You know, so I think that it will ramp back up very, very shortly. We can tell already from inquiries, from negotiating with people, from taking them out, from seeing where the pulse on the street is. So it's every day, it seems like there's better opportunities to purchase real estate in New York. I'm quite optimistic about that.
And by the way, to highlight in our conversation previously, you know, you said you're kind of an eternal optimist in many ways, and you've seen that demonstrated with New York's resiliency historically. And so you don't see a reason why this should really be that different. Although it's a different trigger, the outcome you believe will be the same or close to it.
It is. Going almost 20 years back after 9/11, it was a terrible event. And for the first few months in the marketplace, if you talk to most brokers, many developers, they said, no one's going to live in high rises ever again. This is the end of the city of Manhattan. So many people moved to Long Island, so many people to New Jersey. We have a short memory, and there's something about the vibrancy of the city. That, first of all, there's employment and economical opportunities are going to continue to draw more people back into Manhattan, back into the city life, and it will bounce quickly back just like it did before. And I think within the next few months, we're going to see the energy back in the marketplace very much.
Let's go to our next topic on the same vein, though. I mentioned to you in our conversation how there was a big article about how a South American family had spent like $25, $26 million buying 5 apartments in one building on the Upper West Side on Riverside Drive to park some capital. You know, foreign buying of New York City apartments is not a new thing by any means. It had really exploded probably the last 10 to 15 years, whether it be China, South America, in Europe. What is your sense of that buyer base as a general statement in New York City apartments and co-ops? Do you see that changing with this current situation, this current trigger, as you say? Do you see it waning? Any insight in that would be helpful for our listeners.
So let's start with the fact that there are many countries that are in different stages of this pandemic, right? And they may be looking at New York and saying, okay, New York was sort of the epicenter of this thing. And smart investors and buyers, you know, most foreign buyers that buy New York real estate, they'll buy apartments for, you know, for their kids that might be coming to school here or for college, but mostly it's an investment. They buy it to preserve their wealth and to diversify it into a New York blue chip real estate. So usually a sophisticated buyer, that type of a buyer, and they understand the longevity in the marketplace, and they understand that historically, no matter what happened, the value of real estate in New York City is always maintained, and the graph is always on the way up, you know, over time, over decades. So if you think about it, short-term values, there are corrections. That might be the opportunity to buy it at a better discount than they did, that they would have 6 months ago to a year ago. We are already seeing bigger investors, like, for example, big family billionaires from the UK.
Yeah, Rubin Brothers, you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
They're coming in and investing in some of the development projects in the city. They're buying some retail. They're investing, and they've done it through the pandemic because they know there's some distressed situations and there are opportunities here to buy some real estate at much lower costs and see it through the recovery. So I think foreign buyers are more sophisticated. They're long-term. And they will continue to support the marketplace as they always have. And we're seeing the interests already coming in.
Do you think as this pandemic evolves and hopefully dissipates, do you think there'll be a bigger rush to that capital coming here? Or is it constantly a steady state of over time, not really going away, not increasing, but kind of staying as it has been the last 5 years?
Yeah, there will be surges. A lot of it has to do with the global economy. A lot of it has to do with trade agreements. A lot of it. So I don't think that we can predict any one wave or another, but it's always supported the real estate in New York. And so for now, it's steady and constant. And again, we're seeing more of your braver buyers and investors coming in from countries that have already gone through the reopening, and maybe were not impacted as severely as we did in New York City. You know, there are parts of the world that are already fully open, back in business and fully operational. And so the state of mind of these buyers is, and investors, and they're in a completely different place than we are right now.
Right. You know, we're getting a lot of questions, and this really kind of naturally transitions into our next topic. You mentioned 9/11. Obviously, I was in the city at that point when that happened. And I agree with you that the view of being in a high rise, even working in a high rise, was a question people asked themselves. So I want to be on the 54th floor of a building, right, given what had happened. A lot of people got out of the city. They kind of just picked up roots and went back to where they were from or got out of different locations. But the city rebounded, and I agree with you, it rebounded quite strongly, whether it be post-01 or even post-08, right? The city the last 10 years has been a hotbed of technology companies, employment growth, right? Do you think that this time is different? I mean, there are people who are saying it is, right? I don't think COVID's going away, meaning it probably is lasting, going to be around for a long time, whether it be a vaccine that comes in and evolves or a treatment of some form. Working from home, every day that goes by, I believe, kind of ingrains a different consumer behavior, whether it be the way you shop, the way you work, the way you, you know, do things with your friends, the way you eat. So the question that we're getting a lot of, and I want to toss on you, is, do you think that the migration out of the city, it will have be more of a longer term trend? Or do you think this really, again, to your point, is that the city will come back the way it has in previous shocks or disruptions that have happened?
My office faces JP Morgan World Headquarters, right, on 48th Madison. And the back of my chair is a window, and I keep looking down, and I have been watching in the past 6 months to a year the largest demolition in the history, I think, of the world, a 60-story tower that's coming down city block from 47, 48, Park to Madison.
Yep.
And it's making place for their new world headquarters, which is going to be, I think, I don't know, 110 stories, something like that.
I worked there out of college in that building.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So for as long as JP Morgan Chase is going to be headquartered in New York City, and the biggest investment banks in the world, and Silicon Valley, and other industries, and fashions, you're not going to uproot and move all of these industries away from New York City. And so employment is a huge part of this, okay? So the this time is different is always the case. 08 was, that time was different, and 01 was, that time was different, and the tech bubble of 99, you know, 2000, that was different. And so this time is different. Sure, it is different. But there's, again, a new wave of people that come in and offset those who use that trigger and migrated out and decided to change their life and say, okay, I'm going to move into the suburbs. There's a whole new wave of people that come in. As many people that lost their jobs, that many of these jobs are going to come back, but the talent will probably come back with, you know, newer talent, younger talent for less money. It was an opportunity for a lot of corporations to reposition themselves and clean house.
Yep.
I can get younger junior associates with the lower compensation package to come and do the work. They're feeling a bit more brave, and they'll move back and they'll fulfill that space. So New York's not going anywhere. I don't believe in that.
You talked about the frenetic pace that you were getting hundreds of calls in those first 4 or 5 weeks of people looking to get places out east in Jersey and Westchester. Do you see a scenario where those people actually end up putting their kids in schools where they are because of the risk that the city schools don't open up on time or don't open at all? And, you know, they say, you know what, hell with it, I'm just done. Are you seeing any of that from the people that you have put into houses or are looking for homes outside Manhattan right now who are currently have apartments either rented or owned?
There's no question that we've seen an unprecedented wave of people moving into these homes. There is no school out east either at this point. There's no school in the city, but there's no school in Long Island. And so schools have been adjusting to work virtually. You know, my kids do their schooling on their laptops now.
Same. Yep.
It's a lot more comfortable doing it from a 5,000-6,000 square foot house. So I think at least until the end of this year, and we've seen that from the commitment of the leases and the type of the interest from people that have upped and got out of the city. It was not for 2 months. It was not for 3 months. It was not for the summer. Like, we're just going to go out there for a little while and see how this thing plays out. So the school thing is still an issue across everywhere. I don't think they're opening schools anywhere yet.
John, that's a good point. You're right. That is true. I think that's fair. That's actually a good point. Yeah, it's not unique to just Manhattan. But I have anecdotal conversation with friends who are my age or a little younger who are renters in the city now. They have one or two or three kids, and they're saying, there's so many great things about Manhattan or Brooklyn or other kind of the five boroughs, but the cost of living is weighs on them over time, or the inability to find good schooling, have to go to private school. Could this be that push? But your response sounds like it's there's always that backfill of someone else who wants to be Manhattan, who wants that energy, who you anticipate will be the next renter, the next buyer.
100%. And listen, owning a house is very expensive. And it's not just expensive, it's also a commitment. You know, you got to take care of your landscaping, your boiler breaks down, your you know, the problems with the roofs, whatever the story is, you know, it's expensive to run a home. So, you know, these waves, I don't think they're permanent. I think they come and they go. And at some point, someone's going to say, you know, I'm fed up with this house thing. It's a lot of money to keep, a lot of money to run, a lot of money to keep that pool heated and the house, you know, temperature. And maybe it's time to move back to the city. So again, it's a trigger for certain people. On the flip side, there's always going to be those who will see this as an opportunity to finally be able to afford to get back in the city. And so they'll fill in the space. It's kind of like, to me, it's more like musical chairs.
If I was to give you a scenario in the following manner, if you saw a more ingrained move to the work from home, right, where you mentioned Twitter, I think you mentioned Facebook at one point said, you know, there's a caveat to that. You're going to make less money if you move out of San Fran, right, or you move out of New York. If that trend does become more ingrained because technology is, like you mentioned, the way technology is impacting in some good ways your business to continue to flourish, this could also be ways that other businesses, whether it be Yield Street or Nest Seekers or Barclays or other companies we talked about, they can also find that, hey, I don't need 2 million square feet of office space in the top 5 gateway city markets in New York, in the country. If that does happen, I know there's like always various scenarios and risk outcomes based on those scenarios, but if that should take a more direct and firm hold, I have to imagine that takes an impact on New York City home prices and rental rates. And the question is like how to quantify that. Or do you disagree, which is possible too?
I don't disagree, but again, I don't think there's going to be something systematic. There will be shifts in certain businesses and certain companies, but there will be others that will come in and fill in that space. So if office space has now adjusted dramatically, it opens up opportunities and options for new companies that are well-funded, that didn't overextend themselves, that might want to get back to certain boutique manufacturing or certain people with more optimistic and new ideas that want to come in and set up shop. And having a larger office space now is a value proposition compared with 2-3 years ago. So we have a glut. There's no question that we will have a glut. There's no question that there's a lot of companies that will give up space and be an adjustment in the marketplace. We've experienced an unbelievable period of boom in the real estate market. There's so much development. There's so many new office buildings. There's so many big complexes such as Hudson Yards and Brooklyn, the Navy Yards. And, you know, there's so many different massive urban development projects that will put pressure on prices and a tremendous shadow inventories of condominiums that haven't hit the marketplace yet. Sitting, you know, you're sitting on 300 units, but there's only six of them, on the market.
Listed. Right.
Pretty easy. And so it will take time to absorb all of that and to readjust. But I don't see Yield Street or Nest Seekers not having office space anymore.
Right.
I can tell you that many of our agents are eager to get back. You can only do so much on Zoom. That gets old after a while. There is something that happens in the workplace, in an office environment, the type of energy that is created, the work productivity that I don't think you can replicate. You know, we need that as a society and as a working society. We need that energy together. So, you know, more can be done from home, but we're not, you know, stopping the office business.
You know? So just to give you my two cents, I actually agree with you. I think what is going to change is I think there's been a hesitancy from the decision makers at these large companies who have been working for 20, 30, 40 years, who have resisted to some degree a work from home balance. And I'm not saying it's 5 days work from home, 5 days in the office, but there's probably going to be a pendulum shift, I believe, where there's more flexibility of, okay, come in Monday morning and work from home Friday, and then Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you split between the office and your home if you have an event to take care of or personal, you know, issue of some sort. I just think the balance of when you go to the office and when you're from home is going to be more balanced historically than it's been. So if you think most people are 95% office, 5% home, I think that could shift 70-30, 70 office, 30 home, right, on days.
I agree with that 100%, yeah.
Their avocations of what that looks like, I think, is going to be telling how each company takes a different approach to that. But I think people commute 2 hours, 2.5 hours daily. I think there is some benefit to maybe 1 or 2 days a week from home and getting that time back and being more productive with your time. And so I think
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, agreed with that.
One topic that I want to talk about, and then we'll go to questions, is, you know, the high end condo market is something that people in New York are always enthralled with, right? You read about these $50 million, $70 million, $200 million apartments, the one on Central Park South, right, that bought by Ken Griffin. There's so much coming online the next 12 to 24 months of full floor units at a price at 25 million plus. How in the world are those ever sold in what looks like a tougher market with more supply? Like, are you very concerned about that? And if so, how are you advising your clients?
Never been that much inventory and that much development banking on the depth of the ultra luxury marketplace. The sellout period has to factor in now 5 to 7 years, possibly 10 years to absorb this inventory.
Holy cow.
Yeah, there should not be another project of that size for probably another 3 to 5 years before the next wave of those things will go into planning. I think that there are things that you can't stop. The shovel's in the ground or it's been funded. You know, you have to execute. You're in the middle of execution or you're done. You know, the project is almost done and it's going to have to come to the marketplace. But we have a ultra luxury space, and it, you know, it depends how you define luxury and ultra luxury, right?
Right.
Is it 5 to 10? Is it 10 to 20? Is it 20 plus? But wealthy people, you know, remains wealthy, and we've seen the stocks bounce back now to what, about 7-8% below the high.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
So there's definitely a much longer sellout period. And so we have to be prepared for that. And so developers are probably all working out longer extensions on their development loans or inventory loans and how long they're going to take to offload. Look, there's a project 157, which was really the first building that on billionaire roll, right?
Yep.
It's going on 10 years. It's not sold out yet.
Yeah, it's right.
So I think these projects are 10-year sellouts. But, you know, it's New York real estate, most prime piece of real estate in the world. And the ultra-high net worth community collects these homes for preservation. It's a hobby for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So I think over time, it will get absorbed. And there will be incredible opportunities there and price adjustments. A lot of these transactions are done behind closed doors.
Yep.
Right. So I don't know that you will see that data reflects in the marketplace. You know, there's a lot of creativity in how those deals are going to be done. but there's certainly great opportunities in that space now.
I want to hit on a couple of questions. We have about 10 minutes left, and I'll kind of curate them real quickly, Eddie. So one question we got is rentals. You know, we talk about condo, co-op on the sales side. On the rental side, collections have been actually pretty good in Manhattan so far. How concerned are you about owners who may get out of the city and try to put their unit on the rental market, competing with other rental properties? How much do you see rents, maybe you don't see at all, but do you see rents dropping? And if so, are we talking a 10% drop, a 20%, 25%? Like, where are you seeing, again, it's early, I realize that, but the summer is typically the most busy leasing season for new college grads coming into Manhattan, right? And people moving in the summer, no one really moves in the wintertime. But that could be really disrupted this year because of COVID. That could maybe result in people saying, okay, I'll cut my prices 20% to fill my vacancy. Tell us about what you think is going to happen with that.
So a lot of the rental inventories offset by buyers that have become renters now, right? They're thinking a little bit more, you know, maybe we should wait. There might be some price adjustments in the sale. In the meanwhile, let's go out and rent. And so we've seen a good shift on that side. So, and you have sellers that don't have to sell that are thinking there's a good time to rent or just take things off the market. So it's still too early to tell what the overall impact is going to be. I spoke to a head of a rental firm earlier in the day, and they're one of the largest firms here in New York, and they're almost at levels back in terms of inquiries. You know, if they go back May over May of last year, there might be down 15-20% in terms of traffic and transactions. You know, so they're hitting their transaction base virtually, you know, following all rules and guidelines, but they're at 80%, 85% capacity year over year in this past week, 2 weeks in terms of volume of rental transactions.
Got it. So
the activity is there, right? The activity is there. I don't know what it's going to mean statistically, and you know, in the next few months we'll know, but I can tell you that day-to-day operations are resuming all around in the rental market just as well.
Right. There's one more question I want to touch on, then we're going to hop. We talked about New York City as a government entity, right? Relies so heavily on real estate taxes, on sales tax. There's a huge talk of this massive hole in their budget, right, for the next, you know, year or so, right, just as volume goes down. Are you at all hearing people concerned about just what direction the city takes away from the real estate aspect, just from the political environment and the health of the city itself? I mean, it's a big issue with MTA and other kind of service that people are accustomed to, maybe having an impact on that from what's going on.
There's a lot of moving parts. You know, there's the elections. There's a bit of the tension between the mayor and the governor. I think that a lot of things have to be worked out politically just as well in order to get us back on track. But they tend to work themselves out. You know, they tend to work themselves out because the city is the fuel and the economy of New York City revolves around capitalism. And so whether you're going to be on the left or on the right or whatever legislations are going to pass, it's always going to be in favor of capitalism and to keep the energy and commerce going. And so I'm not concerned. I'm not going to get into political views at city, state, or
federal level, right?
Federal level. But I think in the case of New York, it'll work itself out.
Last question, we're going to jump. I'd like one more. Short-term versus long-term, if you had money to invest in residential real estate in New York City, whether it be co-op or condo, would you wait to see more price decrease and maybe find a more opportune time? Or would you say that there are deals now for our investors to go and find opportunities to invest money in residential real estate?
Now is the time. Now is the time. And that now is the time period is going to come to an end soon. The money is made on the purchase, right? Someone once told me, you make money when you buy, not when you sell. So I made some moves on the Dow on March 17, 18, but not as aggressively as I would have liked to.
Of course. Yeah, we never do.
No one does. No one wants to buy when there's blood on the streets. You know, only the brave ones do. So we're at that period now where we're starting to see some optimism. We're starting to see sentiment increasing, and we're starting to see more vibrancy in the marketplace. The inquiries are coming in. And so if sellers feel that there is a market, they'll become less and less and less and less flexible. And that's on, in my opinion, commercial markets, again, will take much longer. But on the residential side of things, I think that window is coming to an end. And so if you're a serious buyer and you're looking for the best opportunity, you'll find now is the time to act and to negotiate circumstances and deals now that you wouldn't be able to do, in my opinion, by fall. Sentiment is going to change in the marketplace.
And with that, Eddie, thank you for that last point. I want to, on behalf of the Yield Street community and the team here, I want to say thank you for your time. Really appreciate talking to you and learning more about your business and Nest Seekers. We value it and we appreciate it. To all listeners, thank you so much for joining us today and stay tuned for our next webinar coming up soon. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7 to 10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.